Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the Creekside Room, is Karen Bloomquist, and the title of her talk tonight is Why War Over Homosexuality. Let's listen in on Karen.
I knew that at some time during my 2 weeks up here, I would have to have a session dealing with some aspect of what is sometimes referred to in our day as the battlefield over sexuality. Let me just begin to, and especially as how, in terms of how that zeroes in on particularly matters of homosexuality. Let me be clear from the beginning what I'm going to try and do, and also what I'm not going to try to do in this very limited session. This is not intended to be a session where we're going to get into the arguments pro and con, should homosexuals be and homosexual relationships be accepted, ordination, and all the other kinds of questions. I would hope that what I'm going to share with you might provide some helpful undergirding for those continuing discussions that I think are likely to continue in our churches as well as in the wider society. I'm also not going to be getting into a real parochial discussion of various dynamics related to the ELCA process of developing a sexuality statement. As many of you are aware, I was a staff director for that project until the beginning of November. And one of the reasons for giving the kind of session that I'm giving tonight is that the primary reason that I am not the director of that anymore is because of the incredible dynamics, the anxiety, the fears, the irrational kind of dynamics that broke out in the midst of that for a number of reasons. Some of them related to the press and congregations not having the study in time, and there's a number of factors, and some of you may want to talk about some of that with me later. But I think what is really extraordinary in our day, whether we're dealing with the ELCA, with Methodists, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, and probably any of the other church bodies represented in this room, is that there have been incredibly tense discussions related especially to homosexuality in all of our denominations. One of the helpful things is that many of us have been involved in ecumenical conversations trying to look at some of the dynamics involved in that. And what I'm sharing with you are some ideas that I've shared as part of a volume, an ecumenical volume on the sexuality debate in the churches today that I think has come out, but I'm not sure if it's in print yet or not. So what I would say an underlying thesis of what I want to lay out this evening is that even though much of the debate regarding homosexuality that's going on in the churches now often hinges on discussions of the Bible. What does the Bible say? How do we interpret Scripture? What is biblical authority and how does that function? Those are the terms that the battle is often fought on. What I'm trying to get at is what are some of the underlying dynamics that have caused the Bible to be used as the weapon by all sides in the debate? And can we try to understand in some more helpful ways what it is that is fueling some of that warfare? So I'm going to just very briefly lay out some things and then invite some comment, and then at the end spend maybe 10 or 15 minutes trying to say, hey, how do we move forward through the kind of polarization and at times warfare over these issues that we seem to be in the midst of. The first item that I have there on the board is that fear and anxiety associated with our own sexuality is, I think, a very, very key factor that comes to the fore in the midst of the debate, and particularly in terms of how the Bible gets used. This includes the fear of our sexuality, of the power of the erotic, and of those who have been seen in one way or another as sexually deviant in our society. Although today there's greater openness in talking about sexuality, the overwhelming tendency is to focus on or even become fixated on the sexuality of those that the dominant group considers to be other from themselves. Men focusing on women's sexuality, heterosexuals focusing on gays and lesbians. And therefore, I don't think it's an accident that a mostly heterosexual church has become so obsessed with talking about homosexuality. In many ways, I think what happens is those of us who are heterosexual, therefore, try to keep the problem out there in a way that may avoid at times facing our own fears connected with the most intimate aspects of our own lives as sexual beings. Now, admittedly, some of those fears are connected with enormous changes in sexual understandings and expectations over recent decades. For example, the rise of feminism, the growing awareness of sexual abuse and boundary violations. And certainly new awareness as well as lots of confusion as to what is appropriate and what is inappropriate. And I think when we live in times of a state of flux like this, that can stir up some real anxiety in us and within the society as a whole. Those who feel they are losing much of the traditional power they have had may be most susceptible at times to appeals to try to at least control the sexuality of some of these other groups. So I think the fear and anxiety factor really needs to be looked at and analyzed. I'm certainly not a psychologist. I would think that some of you might have some insights as to how that becomes such a driving force in the midst of this discussion. A second item that I have up there and that I'm going to just touch on very lightly is the whole understanding within the wider society that the church will somehow still be the controller of sexuality. And I think this is a predominant expression among a lot of people who might not be that active in the church, who might not really care that much about what the church has to say on anything else. But all of a sudden, if the topic is sexuality and the church, some of us have learned in some very painful ways how that really feeds the media hype. And that becomes a kind of explosive combination because of what has been seen as the church's role in society of maintaining social order and a sense of what is appropriate, what is not appropriate. And so even though we might look around and say, well, the kind of morality that the church traditionally has taught is probably not being lived out by a very large percentage of people anymore, nevertheless, there's the expectation that there will be an ideal, a kind of clear sense of this is right and that is wrong, and the church being expected to be the controller of that. And therefore, I'm saying in that sense, the church as a kind of parent over controlling sexuality. Obviously, there's very different notions of what parent would be in some much more positive ways of that too, but I'll just set it forth in that kind of bold way, and then we can talk some more about these afterwards. Thirdly, and I'm increasingly seeing this as more and more of a key factor. I think we're dealing in our day with a very real clash in worldviews and the way in which we put together the whole of how we understand reality. What I put up there is moral absolutes versus moral discernment. And by that, I'm not suggesting that there aren't some basic principles, some basic values that are basically absolutes for us. The other day we were saying, for example, the basic respect for all persons and some other things that we could say are kind of at the core of what the Ten Commandments and what some basic moral teachings are about. But what I'm talking about is the notion of, on the one hand, a worldview that talks about God and creation in and human reality in very static terms versus a view that talks about such things in much more dynamic terms. In the modern age, there's been more and more of a moving away from fixed static categories with a recognition of how historically conditioned all of life is. But the realm of sexuality has for many been a last standoff, assumed to be a realm of unchanging nature. I'm going to say something about nature at the number five here. That there is a history of sexuality which has varied considerably over time and place is from this perspective viewed as blasphemous. Moral laws, social structures themselves become equivalent with divine reality. And therefore, clinging to unchanging norms and rules becomes an anchor of hope for security in what is admittedly a sea of massive social, familial, economic, and changes in the church. So in the sea of changes, having some things to hang on to, some clear sense of, hey, this is right and this is wrong, serves an important kind of anchor function in terms of our sense of trying to make sense of what's going on around us. One of the writers that I found rather interesting in looking at this is a theologian by the name of Catherine Tanner, who teaches at Yale and who's written a book called The Politics of God. And she describes why sanctifying such fixed, unchanging ways of viewing the social order are problematic theologically. She says that when we try to nail down God and say, well, this is the way, and you can, there's only one way to live out this realm, the economic realm, the political realm, the sexual realm, what happens is we subtly can fall into a form of idolatry, of trying to nail down God and God's activity to a given order. When God becomes tied to a given social order, then we risk violating God's creative freedom and risk being able to discern that in fact God is continually active in new ways, including perhaps in ways that go beyond the bounds of what we have thought of as appropriate, responsible living out of our Christianity through our lives as sexual beings. And so Tanner, I won't go into her whole thesis, but what she does is saying, hey, we really need as Christians to think about our dynamic relationship of dependence on God, and that is what is normative, rather than claiming certain institutions are themselves God-ordained and direct manifestations of God's will to the exclusion of any other possible arrangement. This very much fits in with what we Lutherans sometimes think of as an orders of creation way of thinking. And she really challenges seeing that in such a static, exclusive way that it precludes any other ethically responsible form of relationship other than one form. And I think for our purposes, saying that that can only occur, therefore, in heterosexual marriage. God is free to will a world, Tanner says, in which human efforts alter social orders or may open up possibilities for kinds of relationships in which human flourishing can occur in accordance with God's dynamic intentions for humankind. God wills that our relationships be ordered in just and loving ways, but God does not necessarily will that a fixed moral order that is the same for all time and all eternity. Now, I'm mentioning that, and I'm giving a little bit of airplay here to what Tanner has to say to that, because certainly in the midst of the warfare over homosexuality, I see again and again that there is a kind of absolutism that can come in. And I'm not saying, therefore, there aren't some non-negotiable values that are at the core of how we think of a sexual ethic. But that when things are cast into, you know, charges of absolutism on the other hand or relativism on the other, then the battle just kind of gets, you know, the arrows go zooming back and forth, and we don't, it's hard to see much light at times in the midst of the warfare over these issues. The fourth item that I have up there, and it relates a bit to this moral absolutism versus moral discernment thing that I've just mentioned, is heresy versus idolatry. I began to think about this about a year and a half ago, and I suppose it came out of trying to make sense of some of the voices that we had heard from who were basically saying, well, to in any way entertain the possibility that there might be a morally responsible homosexual relationship is just plain heresy. And it wasn't always in those, the word heresy was used, but it was equivalent kinds of words. And therefore, one of the books that I have found very helpful and that I would recommend to you is a book written by two professors at Wartburg Seminary in Dubuque, Patty Jung and Ralph Smith, have recently published a book called Heterosexism, An Ethical Challenge. And they really get into the way in which heterosexism, namely saying the only thing that can be acceptable is a heterosexual relationship, and therefore that alone is normative and everything else is deviant, is itself, Smith and Jung maintain, a form of idolatry. And there can be a way in which insisting that a heterosexual ordering of our relationships is the only possible way they can be ordered, that itself can be a subtle way in which we fall into idolatry. Let me just read to you a portion of what they have to say here. By reducing sexuality to male-female dichotomies, heterosexism creates an idolatrous focus on one part of the whole. Idolatry occurs when anyone or anything is invested with more significance than is fitting. As an interpretive framework, heterosexism is idolatry. And perhaps more than anything else, the New Testament witness reveals that Jesus' life, death, and resurrection were a confrontation with idolatry. Now that may sound a little bit strange to you, and I don't think in any way are Smith and Jung, nor am I trying to insist that or deny that there are some clear heterosexual assumptions operating in Scripture. But what they are saying, and what I think there is some historical basis for saying, is that we in our modern era, and I'm thinking now especially post-17th century, have put far more weight into a kind of male-female absolute distinction, and they're therefore saying, opposites attract and one sex needs the other, a kind of absolutizing of the distinction between male and female and how that then comes together in a heterosexual order, that simply was not true for much of history. One of the interesting books that deals with this is a book by Thomas LaCour on, it's called Making Sex, Body and Gender from Greeks to Freud. And he does a rather interesting historical survey of how up until about the 17th century, even in medical textbooks, the kind of absolute distinctions that we associate with being male or female were far more fluid. For much of that history, to think of there being an absolute distinction between male and female genital organs was not the case. It was female organs were seen as inverted versions of male organs, it's a very strange way of thinking because we are so conditioned by our modern culture, and especially by a lot of 19th century historical developments that talked about, well, males are like this and females are like this, and then those historical distinctions began to be understood as being somehow natural. But what LaCour and a lot of other historians of sexuality, I think, are helping us to see is that those distinctions that we've assumed to be natural are far more conditioned by our society. And certainly within our own time, we can look at many cultures around the world where the kind of male-female distinctions that become the basis for the absolutizing of a heterosexual order were far more fluid and not nearly as absolute as we've tended to think of them in our own day. So I think that really blends into the last point there that I have on the board, namely, I think the warfare over homosexuality begins to surface a lot of very complicated discussions over what is natural and what is unnatural. Certainly those who have followed the flurry of discussions of the causes of homosexuality are aware that even though in many ways the jury is still out and there's still a lot of questions that aren't resolved, there seems to be increasing evidence that one's sexual orientation, whether by nature or nurture, although probably now it's looking more by nature than by nurture, that becomes a given. And therefore, to think of what is natural in terms of what does it mean to live out one's sexual orientation in a God-pleasing way, what does that mean for those who are homosexual and whose orientation has become for them natural? So I think there's a lot of tough questions there, and I think they all come clashing together when the topic is homosexuality. They have to do with our social order, with lots of fears, with lots of things related to how we view the world. And all of these things then feed into the lenses with which we then read scripture and read the passages that are often raised up, when we talk about this. I think the unfortunate problem is that those texts are very few, and we therefore often read them in a way that we ignore the rest of the biblical witness in terms of how we are to relate to one another in Christ. So let me just pause for a while. I'm sure you have lots of questions, lots of comments, partly because I've tried to, I could spend a half an hour on each of these points, and I really try to condense so much, so some of it is probably not very clear, and I really invite not only your questions of clarity, but also some challenge of this, as well as some other factors that you think are key in the kind of heated atmosphere over this, the heat that is there when we talk about homosexuality. Let me also say that another factor, a very key factor, that I didn't get into, because she's actually spending five sessions unpacking this, is the purity issue that Lori Miller is dealing with in her sessions. And I think that certainly needs to be factored in, and to some degree relates to, you know, the fear and the anxiety and the what is natural. I mean, but it's a more explicitly biblical theme that I didn't list here, but it certainly undergirds a lot of this.
Yeah, one of the things that I said in that class, we don't tend in our culture to think about things in terms of pure and impure usually, but I've been given to understand that we discover a purity issue whenever we have a gut reaction against something. And so I think that sort of goes kind of the anxiety. And there's a feeling of repulsion. Mm-hmm. And that also ties in with the natural.
I always find it very interesting. I think that your point number two is church as controller. How very interesting it is that every time we seem to be in a time of instability or wonderment, whether why society is breaking down or whatever, and I don't think this is unique to 1994, but I think this has been historically true, how the church ends up as the focal point, the one to fix it. And I think that's right. Why this is so heated in our churches is because in many ways, there is some sense of pressure from the outside that we are responsible to do something, whether it's legitimize it or crush it or whatever, but the pressure there is enormous from all parties involved.
Right.
And the church takes on a really interesting role, and like you were saying, especially from people who may have nothing to do with the church otherwise, but all of a sudden find it a great ally in their cause, whichever way they tend to be.
Well, and related to that is the fact that in the popular culture, what is the immediate connection that people make when they think of sin? Sin has to do with sexual sins. Now, we might do all the preaching and teaching we wanted to talk about the broader understanding of the reality of sin and to help people understand that sin is more than just acts. It's the, you know, kind of power of domination, and it's, you know, but nevertheless, the discrete sexual acts that are seen as sinful becomes the synonymous with what the popular culture views as sin. Other comments? Yeah.
Furthermore, there's a hierarchy of sin, like it or not. I mean, we don't teach that. We teach sin separates us from God. But there is a definite hierarchy of sin which adds another weight, another dimension to cause this to be a frightening thing. And we haven't changed that attitude.
So say more about the hierarchy.
Well, I mean, sexual sins are somehow viewed in the general population as being worse than gossiping or some other false witness sins
or greed,
you know. And it's kind of interesting. That adds further fuel, if you will, to the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the fear that we have experienced. Homosexual has for a number of years been considered queer, quote unquote, and I use that, I guess, to make a point.
Mm-hmm.
And so to combat it with whatever research comes in, it's very hard to erase that bias.
Yeah, we're trying to deal with something on a rational level that is far from rational.
Right. And even the, you know, the thing that surprised me is I thought as the evidence came in that it was weighted heavily in the nature rather than nurture category, that would be helpful. And then I remember participating in a discussion with a group, and the argument was basically that alcoholism is genetically, so therefore, but you can find a cure for alcoholism, and we get back into the old trap of not really realizing its orientation, but something we have to find a cure for. And it's really complex. And that surprised me. I don't know why I didn't think of that aspect.
How about some other factors that you see fueling the heat about around these discussions? Gail?
Karen, do you think the AIDS epidemic intensifies feelings? I see that myself.
How do you see
if
that?
If AIDS was not a question, if AIDS was not around, I don't know that we'd have the intensity one way or the other in the argument. But I see, because it's a life and death thing focused upon homosexuals, that it becomes very intense for a lot of people, that it might not be as intense if AIDS were not around. And that's my own opinion.
Well, and all the characterizations that then rush in of it being a gay disease.
Right, right.
The very unfortunate character.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I guess I'm a little concerned that your statement at the beginning, you didn't want to get into the issues, but just kind of the all of this background. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me what you have up there is definitely a biased, slanted background. Because all those are arguments used against those who hold the, quote, traditional position of the church. Seems to me. The fear and anxiety bit, the church's obsession with sex.
How would you phrase those then in a more neutral way? I mean, I guess I'm not denying there may not be bias in how those are phrased, but I would like help in terms of some ways of identifying what's at stake in the warfare there that might be more neutral.
Well, it seems to me those are challenges toward a person holding a traditional position, for the most part.
They're realities in the workplace, if you're working with people that have AIDS, because I've been in that situation. And the fear and anxiety, we had one woman that was even afraid to sit at the desk of a man who was a homosexual. He was very clean, we had to change desks, and she absolutely refused to accept the assignment to sit in his desk. So I call that a personal fear and anxiety that we had known this man for years.
Because of fear of
AIDS. It was irrational.
Because of the fear of AIDS.
AIDS from sitting in his desk.
Yeah.
But did she know he was homosexual prior to the time that she knew he had AIDS?
He did not have AIDS. We had a lot of people at work that didn't have it and died, but he did not.
Okay, so did she know he was homosexual all along?
Yes.
I guess I was wondering.
I don't know if there's any more comment on the point that's being raised. Did you want to?
Well, what I was just trying to do was go through that list in my own mind. As if I were a homosexual person. If I were a homosexual person, I certainly would have lived my life with a good deal of fear and anxiety about whether or not I was going to be accepted into the culture. If I was a homosexual person, I would have great fear of the church, knowing that the church was the controller of social mores regarding sexuality. If I was a homosexual, I would know that the almost insurmountable barrier I had to overcome was the notion of moral absolute. I would know that most people considered me to be a heretic, an idolatrous of my own body, and I would know that I was on the outside of what contemporary culture called natural. So it seems to me you could read that list from the other side, maybe as equally powerful. I don't know if that's responsive to your question or not, but that's what I tried to do, was switch sides of the issue and ask how would I react to those categories.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
And especially...
Maybe it was the way you presented them.
That could be. That could be. And partly because I can't deny not having some emotion connected with some of the warfare that I've been involved in around this. But especially these two are our attempts to say, now, what are the two poles? If we can talk about two poles in the debate, what are they saying? You know, here it's one say, well, there are certain absolutes and that's it. You know, it's clear, and we shouldn't have to debate, we shouldn't have to spend time deliberating this in the church. And others saying, well, no, we've got to discern, because there may be some situations where we need to question what we've assumed were the absolutes. So this is an attempt to contrast two positions. These are admittedly more fighting words here. You know, to even propose that the church, you know, might accept the morality of a homosexual relationship is heresy. And then on the other hand, to cling in such absolute terms to certain structures and say there's nothing moral beyond that is to make an idol of those structures. So there, you know, these clearly are fighting words. And intentionally I've posed it that way because I think at times it becomes that way from one side or the other. And so I'm really trying to therefore pose this in a way so we can say, you know, is this in a sense what's going on? And therefore, how do we get beyond that kind of polarized way of fighting over it? So that there can be a reasonable discussion over something we've already said tonight is deeply irrational in terms of the forces that are driving it and that we feel in our gut when these issues come up. Other comments about...
I think where a lot of it still comes from is that people were taught back when growing up saying it's wrong, and that's what they're still clinging to, and they're not willing to look at anything else because you can't get past that's what they were brought up.
Yeah, and I want to give that a really fair hearing, because I think when some people begin to discuss this, it's like, my goodness, now I'm being asked to overturn, you know, what I believed in, you know, and the parents and the teachers that I have great respect for. I mean, you're telling me that I should just throw that all out or question all of that? And so I think that, you know, I want to at least give due recognition about the fact that, you know, even some mild questioning, and I'm not talking, you know, or saying something like, oh, well, yeah, we should marry homosexuals in the church or, you know, something of that dramatic a move. I'm just saying small steps become upsetting to, you know, some of those very basic tenets that we learned and therefore, I don't think we should, we need to be gentle with one another as we discuss this, because we're at different places in how we have, what we've appropriated, how we've appropriated that, what we've processed, what we've been exposed to, the experiences we've had in the workplace or others, friends, relatives who are gay or lesbian. Although I think that probably has been one of the key factors affecting how people view this issue is their own experience with people that they've known.
Well, I'll push that another step here and say, even if I could give up my fear there, I'm going to be tremendously anxious over where I can go now to find new, reliable moral anchors on which to order life.
Yep.
And I think this threat, as I perceive it for myself, the greatest anxiety lies around the new book that you mentioned for the Warburg faculty members, this notion that somehow we might unbundle what has to be, gee whiz, about the most, what feels like the most fundamental order of the human life since the beginning, which is that there is male and there is female. And if that comes unbundled, then where will I find any good ground to stand on that isn't moving? I want to translate those words from last Sunday. You have the words of eternal life into, you have the words of eternity. They won't change. And if they do change, man, where do I go now? What's the new anchor spot? And how do I live a life that isn't anchored if that's what's being proposed?
Right.
Wow. That's
well, and don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that they're saying in their book that somehow male and female are not the basic pattern by which most of us live out our relationships.
That conversation is certainly going on, though.
You know, it's how we use the word normative
in a
way that excludes anything other than the norm. That's the way it gets used. Yeah.
I want to underscore what I was just saying over there about being taught that this was absolutely wrong.
Yeah.
And this was undergirded by an instinctive repulsion, as it were, to the so frequently mannerisms of the gay community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But as a paleontologist, I became confronted so much of the time with complete gradation in the whole biological world. Be it single cell things or multiple complicated critters.
Mm-hmm.
There's an infinite variety.
Mm-hmm.
I spent my career trying to determine species and what's a variant and what's a new species and so on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another factor is our knowledge of human biology and the fact that psychiatric community no longer classifies homosexuality as a mental problem. That's been, for years it was tried to treat it, even to the fact of muddling the brain and whatnot, you know, frontal lobotomies and this sort of thing, trying to change it. So, I'm convinced in my own mind that God did not only create the rest of the biological world in male and female and everything in between, but also mankind. And your statement about recognition of these variants prior to the 17th century would seem to undergird support that somewhat, though I'm certainly no student of that. But I, in my own mind, Atlantic Monthly about 2 years ago had an article on the biology of human sexuality, which is most amazing thing. Given all these things, then I see these letters to the editor in the Lutheran Anonymous of people that are hurting, people who are trying to be good Christians, good Lutherans, and are really hurting for some recognition, for some acceptance for the way they are. Not because they're left-handed or colorblind, but because they have a homosexual orientation. And it seems to me that basically then we need to think in terms of justice and mercy to give these people some sort of a vehicle to carry out their urges and desires just as we heterosexuals do. Perhaps we need to develop a whole new language and a whole new system of approaching this. But it seems to me that this is ultimately, and one might ask, why is all this coming up now? Why is homosexuality so suddenly becoming, or not suddenly, but becoming such an issue? And of course, part of it's AIDS, but I think part of it's a recognition that the scientific community is recognizing this as a natural thing, and that these people have taken heart. And let me say, as a that I am as disgusted and repulsed as much by the radical homosexuals and all their misbehavings as anyone. But I think there are those who deserve better treatment.
Let me bring up one example that I think speaks to two or three of the points you've been making. A few months ago, I had a gay man come up to me, and in the first draft of the sexuality statement, there's a whole discussion, which is where everybody focuses their attention about the deliberations about homosexuality. And it's followed right after by a whole section on standing against sin, where there's some rather clear things against adultery, against promiscuity, against sexual abuse, a number against the way sexuality is used in the media. He said, as a gay man, that is the section I most appreciate. Because as a Christian gay man, this is the first time that I have felt my church has, first of all, included me in the us, in terms of, you know, we all as Christians are called to live out our sexuality in responsible ways, you know, drawing on some of the Pauline understandings of what responsible expressions of our sexuality are. And he said, at least when I read that section, I feel there that, first of all, I'm a part of the ethical conversation, but I'm therefore called to a new accountability, to say, hey, therefore I, as a gay man, who is also a Christian, need to stand against some of the practices within the gay community. And so he was very clear about that, and I found a very interesting take on that, because he was saying, if anything, I want the church to helpfully engage with the ethical dilemmas that I am facing as a gay man. And at this, up until, you know, basically until recent times, I've been told, well, there is no ethical living out of my sexuality other than abstinence. And so, you know, I think we need to think of what has been the message that has been given off previously by the way the church has approached it. Back row.
Yeah, I think keep in mind maybe a more neutral situation, how the church has either gotten into or has been put into a position of having to speak to some of the scientific social issues. Think back to the 1600s with Galileo, who was almost excommunicated, or was, by virtue of saying that maybe the earth is not the center of the universe. And that, up until that time, that was commonly accepted, much as we probably accept certain things now. And I think only recently has the Roman Catholic Church said, well, maybe they were wrong. Now that's been, what, a number of years. So that here, we put, again, as an example, where sometimes we, or the church itself, however we define the church, gets into things, or it gets forced into things that look awkward by virtue of a historical perspective. And I dare say that we probably are focusing on this and therefore avoiding some of the other more serious issues that we should be dealing with as a religious community, including poverty and hunger and some of these other things. I think history will see how we use this to divert our attention.
I think 20 or 30 years from now, this period of time is going to look very, very strange in the church history books.
Wild fuss.
Pardon?
Wild fuss, huh?
Yeah.
Good.
Maybe a couple other points. I do want to say a few more things, but let's get a couple more
comments.
Could
it be that some of us, over our lifetime, have not been exposed to homosexuality? Homosexuals. I mean,
Not knowingly, anyway.
Is there 3 to 10%? Yeah. I haven't had contact with them, and maybe that's one reason I have problems with this.
What we don't know becomes pretty scary.
For me, there's another warfare up here, and it's basically, I guess in Lutheran terms, law and gospel, that we have very specific statements throughout Scripture that certain sexual acts, heterosexual acts as well as homosexual acts, are, quote, wrong. That's very clear as law. But then we have Jesus himself with the whole incident of the woman's adultery and the whole idea that these are not unforgivable sins. And for me, that's a constant wrestling. Mm-hmm. Where am I the judge? Where am I the forgiver and all that?
Where is their boundary busting, to quote Jan? And or was that your phrase you were using?
Yeah.
And where does that where do we risk collapsing an important dialectic there between law and gospel?
Where does the church stand? I mean, yes, there are sexual sins. We have a responsibility to condemn those, and yet we have the same responsibility to love the sinner. And that's, for me, it's constant tension. Yeah. Where does one stop and the other begin? Yeah.
But here we're struggling with what is a sin. I mean, at the church I was in, this was a big cop-out, is, well, we just hate the sin, but we love the sinner. And that's not admitting that maybe these people and their orientation is not necessarily sinful. Now, how do we define sin, in a category of sin? So.
One of the things that I think this discussion has opened up, and I this also goes with what I think Jan's been doing in the morning of stressing the importance of really in-depth biblical study. It's opened up, I think, a lot of, exposed a lot of the lack of biblical and theological and ethical teaching in the life of our church. So that what people hang on to are, hey, the stuff they learned as kids, the stuff they hear in the culture, the culture's portrayal of the church and sex. And there's a lot of really in-depth work that I think need, and I'm not just talking around sexuality, but how do we use scripture, how do we think ethically, as I was saying on Monday, it's not just a matter of saying, well, what does the Bible say? There's other sources, there's ways in which our experience, like it or not, feeds into how we do ethics, how we approach issues like this. And so I want to just conclude with some further remarks, and you may have some comments after that, but I want to get 2 cents worth in before we end this. I want to suggest that to get beyond some of the warfare over homosexuality and especially over the discussions of it, we need something of a paradigm shift from at least 2 directions. On the one hand, we need to move from a stance of what can at times be macho fighting over this issue to one of trying to bridge and to make connections with one another. In the midst of our vulnerabilities, and admitting that we all are, in one way or another, vulnerable human beings who are also sexual beings. Fighting over sexuality contradicts what is at the heart of God's intention for human sexuality. Namely, that our sexuality is a means by which we express and deepen our relationships with one another, and not a means by which we exploit, dominate, abuse, or break relationships with one another. I think a lot of the warfare kinds of stuff going on around these issues is so utterly crazy because it just totally contradicts what it is that God's gift of our sexuality is all about anyway. There's an urgent need for communities of faith to be safe places, havens from the continual wounding of judgment and life-destroying words and actions, for the church to be a space where we need not worry about being shamed, battered, or abused once again. And I think the sad commentary is that we're discovering how unsafe the church often is for these kinds of discussions.
The church needs to be a healing place of grace, forgiveness, new life, place where we are able to share our pains, our struggles, our shortfallings, and to do so assured of adequate protections against the harm that can occur when we begin to become or open up some of these vulnerabilities. We have much to confess, much that remains broken, and much that speaks of God's presence in our lives. Secondly, we also need to shift from either equating the gospel with a kind of liberal tolerance or acceptance. That's not what I'm saying by saying, well, somehow, you know, and I think there's a tendency to say, oh, well, anything goes. And that's not what we as a church need to be saying. But we need to become a gospel-formed community of faith that is able, honestly, to face and to grapple with ethical dilemmas as people actually experience them in their lives as sexual beings. I think that's what that gay man who made that comment to me was asking for. I want the church to be a place where my struggles as a gay man can be taken seriously and where I'm not just discounted or somehow assumed to be subhuman, that I, you know, there's no way I can act ethically. We need to become communities that have enough trust to challenge, to offer guidance, and mutual correction to one another. I think we're a long ways from being at that place too, because to get to that place to be able to provide mutual correction means a much greater amount of acceptance of the wholeness of who we are before we can do that without a bunch of, you know, kind of platitudes, or I'm going to tell you how you should live your life. God gave us the Torah out of recognition of the human need for dependable boundaries within which relationships of righteousness and compassion can flourish. Jesus knew well the law and the sexual boundaries of his tradition, but he interpreted them in a more profound way, focusing on internal desires as well as external acts. Read Matthew 5, 27 through 28, for example. Although structures, laws, and boundaries are necessary for life in society to give us some sense of social order and predictability and to show us God's intention, they cannot become more important than the qualities of mutual love, trust, and justice that our sexual relationships, which are grounded in God's relationship with us, are to embody. Jesus repeatedly challenged some of the common social boundaries of his day in order to reach out and to relate to those who were oppressed by some aspects of the law. The New Testament church's understanding of sexuality were a direct counter to today's liberal toleration of whatever people do in private is okay. Through baptism, according to St. Paul, we belong to God. We are members of the body of Christ. So what we do with our bodies sexually is important. The challenge to the community, however, is how to express that concern in ways that move beyond the controlling power over sexuality that has so long characterized the church's guidance and has helped excuse, if not justify, oppression and abuse. Most communities of faith have a long way to go before they can become communities that are genuinely helpful in helping people live out their sexuality in ways that are faithful and responsible. But I guess one of my hopes is that there are some glimpses of that beginning to occur in those thousands of congregations of not just Lutheran, but we could say tens of thousands of lots of denominations that have begun talking about these matters. In the process, discovering the brokenness and the woundedness in their midst, and at least in some
glimpses, beginning to experience the healing presence of God in their listening and in their expressions of compassion toward one another. It's the presence of God's Spirit that enables the kind of community in which communication about what matters most to us sexually can begin to occur, and thereby a new sense of what it means to be the church, an image of the people of God in deep and enduring relationship with one another. So I'd want to end by saying that despite some of the warfare around this and some of the fallout related to that, which has been extraordinarily abusive at times, that I think there are some real signs of hope, that hopefully we as church bodies are learning something through this and are able to discern, you know, what is it that's really central in our faith